Hey, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, ever striving to be fact-based, open to divergent perspectives, and always actively optimistic. Today we're going to conclude with the second part of my conversation with Ian Harrison. He's president and CEO of Bipartisan Climate Action. That's a political action committee that supports Republican and Democratic incumbent members of Congress who will act to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Ian Harrison continues making the case that bipartisanship here in the United States is not only possible, it's necessary if we're going to successfully do our part in remediating and adapting to climate change. So here we go with part two. You referred a little earlier to required investment, and a lot of required investment really in areas that you sketched out for us. Typically, and I think that I'm fairly accurate in this, conservatives don't like government spending money, just as a big picture concept. Although, you know, aside, sometimes it seems like it depends on like, okay, well, what are they spending it on? But is there a place for the private sector to be investing in what we're talking about? And why would they do that?
Yeah, I think you've made a very good point. And I should validate some your sense of this. I think historically, there's been an idea that one side of the aisle is capable of spending money and taxing and maybe running up debt, and the other aisle would rather not. It hasn't been true for a while. Republicans are more than capable of spending money and money they don't have in exactly the same way as a Democratic House has been. I'm not sure I can see the difference between the two of them, and that's why we have a $31 trillion debt. And we should remind ourselves that two-thirds of our spending each year is non-negotiable.
Right.
It's mandate. And this is something people forget. So we're arguing about an incredibly small piece, one-third of the pie, which is going to make it extremely difficult to reduce that debt, which is why everybody should be extremely worried about it. But broadly speaking, with $31 trillion in debt, our asset base of the United States is about $300 trillion. That's how much sort of money we have, you know, broadly in the system, assets, things we own. The cost of addressing climate change is estimated by varying people, but it tends to come in around the $15 trillion over the next 15 to 20 years. And of course, that number goes up the longer you wait to deal with it, because mitigation is part of that. The point being, though, government doesn't have $15 trillion. The only way this gets done is with private money. And that asset capital, the capital that we apply and deploy in our country, we deploy it in interesting ways. Fast food, for instance, has a lot of capital in it. And you have to ask the question, should we be having fast food? And if the people who own a fast food restaurant can make more money on wind turbines, do you think they would stop selling fried chicken and start building wind turbines? And the answer would be yes. They wouldn't hesitate. And this is the absolute magic of the market, is that the money will follow the highest return. Government's job is to facilitate the playing field so that the return is very attractive and, more importantly, stable. So I think we are going to have to do this using the market. We cannot replace the decisions, individual decisions of 300 million people on a daily basis. It's an incredible arbitrage and it works really well. And we know it does historically. We cannot rely on government to fix it. They have already put in a significant amount of our children's money into this, as well as all the other things we've spent money on. And we are going to need private money properly facilitated and properly rewarded to actually fix this and move us into this transition.
Yeah, I think that is really a powerful argument as to why bipartisanship is required. It's not because we want to be nice to each other. It's because if we want to get from A to B, we're going to have to pay attention to what each aspect can bring to the table. And a really interesting point to me is that, you know, the government just doesn't have the money to do this, and it's going to have to come, a chunk of it is going to have to come from the marketplace. And that tells me that we need to have policies that make putting money from the private sector into climate mitigation stuff, it needs to be attractive for them to do that. They're not going to do it just to be nice guys, but if they can improve their return, then they're going to do that.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about being attractive. One of the ways to make private money, to make it attractive for private money to invest and address the issue of the energy transition is to get out of the way. I'll give you a perfect example. We have a process in this country where we try to interconnect new renewable projects into our grid. That process used to take about 2 years. It now takes about 4 years. Over this last decade, nothing special. It's not taken 50 years to get here. It now takes twice as long to do it. And, yeah. and part of the reason is the incredible complexity of allocating the costs of introducing new renewables into our grid and the process that we use. If this Congress was to do nothing else but revamp that process of getting new wind farms integrated into our grid, they would vastly speed up the process because there is a lot of private capital ready to do this, but they're not about to spend 2 to 3 years trying to plan for something that's going to take 4 years to get a permit before they can even break ground. That is an unrealistic expectation of private capital. So the government's job actually is to slightly get out of the way of it.
Yeah, I think that's a convincing point that you make there. I've read recently a CEO of one of these firms who has basically just thrown up his hands and said, forget it. We would love to be bringing clean energy into the grid, but the process is so long. He says they'd already invested a bunch of money. He says, okay, we quit. So really a good point there, I believe, and one that we need to pay a lot of attention to. And also one that when I listen to you, it's like it's hard for me to imagine anybody on either the left or the right saying anything other than, yeah, we need to fix that.
Exactly. And I have to stress again that for the most part, what happens in Congress is small incremental work done across the aisle for the most part. We pass hundreds of bills a year, and they're not all passed by any means on a partisan basis.
I'd just like to talk a little bit more about the current political scene. So one of the things I'm wondering, Donald Trump has just recently announced he's running for president in 2024. So is that two impacts I'm interested in? What impact is that going to have, do you think, on what Congress does or doesn't do? And is that going to have an impact on your efforts to support financially politicians who are climate aware, for a lack of a better term?
Answering the first question, I think it will have an impact on the Republican Party. My sense of the Republican Party's position with respect to the race for the nominee for the 24 presidential election is that there's a lot of work to do, and that's going to distract. Mm-hmm. There is no question about that. And in a way that probably isn't, well, we don't know whether that'll happen on the Democratic side either. That it's not clear how that's going to work, but it will be a distraction, I suspect. But beyond that, though, with respect to climate, I think it's irrelevant. I don't think that Trump in or out of the race is particularly relevant to the topic of climate. The thing about climate is that the climate work and climate discussion is done by people either side of the center of this discussion. The two extremes of both parties have either conflated climate change with so many other aspects that we're no longer sure what we're talking about, or we're using it as a sort of conspiracy model that they are neither sensible conversations on either side of this. And so it's not particularly relevant. I don't think Trump's race is particularly relevant to climate legislation. What I would say, and this is, I guess, important. We backed 17 members of Congress in this last cycle.
Excuse me, I wasn't quite clear. 70 or 70?
17.
Thank you.
Yes, I aspire to sponsoring 70. but we backed 70. They've, with the exception of one who lost his primary, all of them got reelected. They're all climate guys. They're all centrists. Mm-hmm. Many of them have experienced problems in both their own parties, on both sides of the aisle, for their positions on bipartisanship. And they have absolutely demonstrated their bipartisan capability. And as far as I can tell, they're hard workers on their committees and they're hard workers in their constituencies. The point is they all got back in office. Mm-hmm. This is excellent.
Yeah.
I was expecting to lose a third of them. Wow. And they all got reelected. I'm quite hopeful that the faith in the American electorate in many ways has been restored. The centrist ground ultimately appears to be pretty solid around many issues, but also climate. And so I think whoever's running for the top job in 24, current candidates don't look like they're going to affect anything that's going to go in the House, other than the fact there's going to be a bit of a circus. It depends on your point of view. There was a circus last time.
So. I'm with you. My faith in the center has been somewhat restored recently. I full disclosure, I've felt pretty negative about prospects, but this recent election seemed to be one where the center did raise their voice to an extent. And so I talking to you and hearing some of your perspectives at the same time, I become more convinced that A, bipartisan solutions are possible, and B, that they're necessary. So, and that, and it, I think you're saying, and that's about the center. This is about people who are willing to look at data, do the hard work, and come up with solutions. So I'm curious, has there been any trend over the last few years, or however long you want to say, and how much effort it takes to raise money for climate aware candidates? Is there a trend there at all?
I don't know. I'm not entirely sure I've got enough data or enough longevity to talk to trends. I can be more anecdotal about my own experience, okay, which would be useful, and use a little bit of data. Let's start with this year. The environmental money in the system, whether it be individual donors, PACs, or the so-called soft money that runs through these 501c4s, is around the 40 million mark. It's not a large sum of money. Bear in mind, this midterm was, I think, $16.7 billion of spend. The vast majority of that, by the way, is completely waste. It's idiotic in terms of how this money flows around. But and we probably, if we look at the oil and gas industry, we're probably 120 million. So the environmental movement, broadly speaking, is, you know, half, or maybe you would do it the other way around. You know, oil and gas spends 2.5 times what we do on the environmental side. But 40 million is not nothing. What is interesting about that trend, though, is that it is the environmental money is almost entirely, I think around 40 million of it is entirely spent from the perspective of the left hand side of the equation. And the oil and gas money is almost entirely spent on the right hand side of that conversation. The trend, if there is one, is that is beginning to mix up. Now, the driving force in this is interesting. The oil and gas majors, not the extraction guys, but the majors, they're looking for stability. So they're starting to fund members on both sides of the aisle much more. It's difficult because many don't want to take money from oil and gas, but there's ways of managing that, believe it or not. And so that's an important part about how that's moving across. And they're really looking for sensible people to work on sensible committees and pass sensible long-term legislation. Likewise, the money on the so-called eco-left is starting to move quite rapidly into the right-hand side of the equation, because there's been a clear observation that Republicans are actually quite willing to work on reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but they're doing it from a completely different vector. They're coming at it from a completely different point of view, but it doesn't mean they don't want to work on it. So if there is a trend, it's the blending of this money, and it is the increasing of this money. And I have to point out that the increase is a relative increase, because, in fact, the zenith of spending money on climate change actually peaked some time ago. It's been going downhill for the last three Congresses. But the mix of who's getting it is beginning to change. And the way it's being delivered is also beginning to change as well. A lot of it's going more directly to members as opposed to large campaign organizations who typically have a number of agendas that include climate change, which is typically a problem. So there is some trend there. The last one I would say, and this is the one I work on, and if you like, this is one of our mechanics, if you like, of how we do this. The real point of giving money to both sides of the aisle that is specific to reduction of greenhouse gas emissions on a bipartisan basis is the ability to go to leadership and say, we have backed these members precisely because they are working on this specific issue. Leadership needs to hear that members can step out on climate with unpopular positions, survive their primaries, and attract finance, campaign finance. That is an extremely important message for leadership to hear. So that's another trend that's beginning to change. And the right-hand side of the aisle in this last Congress received $3 million, which doesn't sound like a lot of money, but trust me, compared to the 70-odd thousand that was happening in the Congress before, it's a large sum of money.
Yeah. Well, a lot of things that you've highlighted today have actually done a bit to improve my positive take on maybe we can do this. I can't help asking you this. Now, just chatting before we started the interview, I understand that you've got significant roots in England, and I've long been an admirer of the English political system, although I will say that's been shaken a little bit recently.
Yes.
So, but, you know, the situation we're in the United States right now with extreme partisanship and so on, it highlights all of the weaknesses of our political system here. So since you've got a foot kind of in both worlds, what do you think? I mean, do the English have it right?
It's hard to compare systems. A constitutional monarchy and a republic are vastly different systems, although they both sit in the same umbrella as a democracy. I actually do, as somebody who is an immigrant into this country, I actually think our constitution is incredibly inspired. It is a piece of absolute genius. And the thing that's most interesting about it is it was just tested in the most extreme way mm-hmm. possible. And our institutions withstood the test. The fact that you can write a document and put that into practice and hundreds of years later, it's tested in the way that it was and it stood up to it is absolutely fantastic. So I've got a lot of faith in the system and the way it works. I think the comparison to the UK is difficult. The UK is not America in the sense that its days of empire are long gone, mm-hmm. much before we realized they were gone. And the constitutional monarchy and the process of our government is driven on a broad understanding of precedent. Oh. Precedent is fragile. It works when you're in charge and you're running big empires. It's far less effective when you're just a small cog in a European wheel. And then when you exit the whole of the European wheel and stand alone, it begins to look quite precarious.
Yeah.
And so I don't think there's going to be any changes in the UK, but it is less stable than it was.
Understood. Well, once again, you know, your comments as an immigrant about an immigrant in a place to make some really solid comparisons between the British system and the American system, it's another source of optimism for me, which I appreciate because, once again, full disclosure, I'm pretty much in the need of some optimistic shots these days.
I can tell.
Yeah. So as we finish up here, if folks want to support bipartisan climate action, how can they do that?
The simplest way is to give to the PAC. I'm always interested, first of all, in talking to people who just want to get involved and help. That is useful. There is no question about it. There's a vast amount of administration that needs to go into this work. I've got to be honest, we don't pay anyone, including myself, which is one of the things that we decided to do very early on. But bipartisanclimateaction.org is the website. From there, you can sign up and become part of the newsletter and have a good poke around and see who we're sponsoring and why we're sponsoring and supporting those members.
Well, we'll put a link to the website that you referred to there in our show notes, and I'll put instructions on folks how do they get there after the fact. So, Ian Harrison, it's really been a delight talking with you today. As I've alluded to a few times, you've given me a bit of an optimism shot in the arm. You've changed my perspective some on the actual possibility for some bipartisanship going forward with climate change. So thank you so much for being here.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Many thanks to Ian Harrison, not only for joining us on Climate Talk, but for the necessary and important work he's doing in terms of supporting a bipartisan approach towards climate change. One of the most impactful things that Mr. Harrison pointed out during our conversation, to me at least, is that there's literally no possibility that the federal or other levels of government here in the United States can fully fund the transition in infrastructure and resources we have to undertake if we're going to have a fossil-free energy future. Funds are also going to have to come from the private sector. Lots of funds. I think we can all agree with Mr. Harrison as he says that the best way of doing this, the simplest and the most straightforward, is when it's possible to get the government out of the way. That doesn't mean letting go of well-thought-out environmental protections or permitting processes, but I think it does mean that we have to balance every decision we make against the climate catastrophe that's impending if we don't make good, solid, practical decisions. And that also means decisions that can endure over time. And that further means decisions that don't get jammed down anybody's throat. Decisions that have the support of both the left and the right. And we can do that. I'm thinking of the Montreal Accord in 1987 related to ozone, where not only countries around the world were able to come to an agreement, but here in the United States, the decision was supported by both government and industry and environmentalists. It can be done. If government is going to be part of creating the necessary environment where the private sector is willing to make investments and they're creating a fossil-free future, that's politics. And if it's politics, It's up to us to raise our voices and make a difference. You can contact me at john@ccltacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for other programs. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. Check it out, a bunch of good people. Join up or find another organization if you aren't already attached to join your voice with others. This program, along with all other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under programming. So until we talk again, remember that all great victories were almost great defeats, and always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.